We're ready to rock and roll. All right. Welcome to your March 21st, 2007 Rules Committee. Thank you for your patience. We spent a lot of time and energy, not we. Mr. Ruttlinger spent a lot of time and energy getting amendments together. Tonight the plan is to just do a walk through the amendments and take any public testimony and ask questions. And Friday afternoon we hope to move the bill. The bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So that's kind of the plan on Friday, unless the good Senate President is going to allow us to pass a bill with a fiscal impact off the Senate floor, which I don't think he will. So we have two sets of amendments, and I believe Senator Farioli has a third. Let me do a quickie walkthrough in terms of the differences. The -15 amendments tack a GSP funding fee onto audit reports already filed with the Secretary of State. I want to thank, I believe it's the League of Oregon Cities, for bringing this proposal forward. I think folks, I'm sensing that of the lesser of two evils, that generally speaking, folks like the -15s. -16 amendments was the original Legislative Revenue Office suggestion.
You're zipping through these at a pretty high level. Are we going to come back and just revisit the
Yes. Okay. I just wanted to just alert you to the huge distinction, and the other is -16, provide funding for the agency by diverting small percentages of shared revenues to the GSPC before they're sent to cities, counties, state agencies, and school districts. The amendments contain several other changes, and we're going to have Mr. Ruttlinger come in a minute, that are in response to public testimony, conversations with legislators, interested parties. So I'd like to have Mr. Ruttlinger outline the amendments and respond to questions. Two quickie things. I believe Senator Farioli has an amendment regarding funding, and I'd like to give him an opportunity to just share that with folks. I would also let the committee know that Senator Farioli and I have had a conversation about the revolving door issue, and Senator Farioli questions the constitutionality of the revolving door provisions in Senate Bill 10. I am open and willing to have the discussion, if folks are there, to actually do a constitutional, a referral to the voters regarding a constitutional amendment on the revolving door, if folks would like to take that approach. So I'm very interested in that. And since the bill is going down to Ways and Means, there's certainly an opportunity to for further amendments. Senator Johnson.
Is that the only option? Could we, is there not an option of soliciting a definitive, or as close as definitive as you can get, legal opinion, or is referral to the voters the only recourse?
Well, I think, and we'll have Mr. Ruttlinger talk to this issue, I think it's a gray area. I think he's crafted it as narrowly as possible. But until there's a challenge, we're not going to know. And so certainly actually putting the revolving door piece in the Constitution would resolve that issue. And I just, I don't know if we want to go there. So we'll let Mr. Ruttlinger talk about that, I think, if he wants to come up. We'll have him talk about that. Senator Farioli, do you want to make some comments?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thanks very much. Although probably most of them will be germane to the walkthrough, but I did want to point out that we've had ample opportunity for discussion of the issues of Senate Bill 10, cross-party in between leadership offices, and I think that's exemplary. It shows what I think can be done when people focus on the product. And I see a number of changes that have resulted in discussions that we've had here at the committee, and other, I think, refinements of ideas that are embodied in the dash amendments. The 15s and 16s both reflect some of those changes. So I just wanted to appreciate that publicly, and we'll be comfortable to share the concerns that we have about the revolving door issue and about the potential question about restraint of trade on those things. I just wanted to say that if this were to catch on in the building, a lot of the issues that people have with the partisanship might disappear. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You bet.
Mr. Reutlinger, why don't you go ahead and do a walkthrough?
Thank you, Chair Brown. For the record, Ted Reutlinger from the Legislative Council's office. I'll start with the Dash 15 amendments. As you noted, the only difference between 15 and 16 is the funding scheme. And the Dash 15 amendments start with the new funding scheme that replaces the assessment per public official approach in the bill. What the funding scheme in the Dash 15s do is allocates the expenses for operating the GSPC amongst state agencies, counties, cities, OHSU, community college districts, school districts, and local school or local service districts. And the percentage of the total expenses that are allocated to each of those entities is based upon the number of full-time employees that the entity has. How it works is this. The legislature determines the operating expenses for the GSPC and the amount that's going to be allocated to each entity. Then for state agencies, DAS takes that allocation and transfers the money that would otherwise be appropriated to state agencies, transfers the amount of the allocation to the GSPC account. It for semi-independent agencies that don't receive appropriations, DAS is directed to simply assess them and transfer the money to the GSPC account. For OHSU, the legislature diverts the allocation from OHSU's appropriation and sends it to the account. For cities and counties, the money comes out of funds that cities and counties receive from the OLCC. For schools and community colleges, the legislature diverts money that would otherwise be appropriated to those entities. And then finally, for local service districts, they are simply swept up into the calculation that applies to state agencies and are paid for out of the state agency pot. All of that money is then transferred to the GSPC account, and it's continuously appropriated to the agency to fund its operations.
Madam Chair.
Sarah Johnson.
When this amendment was described to me prior to the time that I read it, it was special districts, and now it's local service districts. How does this draft treat special districts?
Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, there are so many definitions of districts in the ORS that it's hard to keep track of them. What we used here was the general statutory definition of special districts, which appears in 174.117, and it lists 25-30 different districts that would be covered by this.
That would be, Madam Chair, that would be swept into the definition of local service districts.
Yes.
Okay, just to satisfy my curiosity, would special districts like ports, cemetery districts, would they be included in this?
A cemetery maintenance district is included. The list is quite long. A port, yes. Ports are covered. Port of Portland is covered. Airport districts are covered. Soil and water conservation districts, irrigation.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that there was a common definition. Oh, lovely. And there are the ORSs. How serendipitous.
All right. Please proceed unless there's any questions.
Okay. Would you like me to do the Dash 16 funding approach?
Sure.
Now?
Sure. Okay. That would be, I think, most useful.
For state agencies, it remains the same as it is in Senate Bill 10. It's different for local governments, for cities, counties, other municipal corporations. They would be assessed based upon a charge that's equal to X percentage. There's a blank in the bill. It would be based on X percentage of the amount that a local government would pay to file its municipal audit report under the municipal audit law. And those fees are based specifically on the amount of total expenditures that a municipal corporation has in their calendar or fiscal year, whatever year is subject to audit. And that is set forth in a chart in the municipal audit law right here. And for example, If a municipal corporation had expenditures of over $500,000 but less than $1 million, their municipal audit fee is $200. If you're over $10 million but less than $50 million, your municipal audit fee is $350. So this would simply charge a percentage of that amount for entities that are required to file municipal audits with the Secretary of State audit reports, and transfer that amount into the GSPC account. It's simply an alternative way of assessing local governments and the local service districts.
Sarah Farrelly, I do think it would be appropriate, since we're talking funding, for you to walk through, and I have two amendments in front of me, but a dash 4 and a dash 18. Would you be willing to just sort of do
it? Madam Chair, I think it's perfectly appropriate because, after all, the funding is, you know, is the issue that we really have to determine.
Mm-hmm. And I just have to say, and I don't know which amendment you're working off of.
I think it's the latest version,
okay.
The one that's still warm, Madam Chairman.
Okay.
It's the dash 18.
It's hot, yeah. Off the press. Okay.
And first, let me thank the folks at the LC because they did yeoman's work, and also we had input from the Treasury. The Secretary of the or the State Treasurer in helping to craft language that will in fact be effective. If we focus on the outcome, the thing that people wanted was a lockbox. The thing that people wanted was a mechanism of funding that is offers certainty and that would be very difficult for future legislatures to tamper with. And in the examples that we have before us in both the dash 15s and 16s, you have a whole lot of accounting going on, even though it's electronic accounting. You've got appropriation by the legislature. You've got a subsequent assessment back to agencies. And then you'd have accounting on both, at least two sides of that equation, and possibly three as the legislature watches to make sure that those folks that were appropriated and those folks that were assessed actually paid what they were supposed to. So you've got a lot of process going on there. The Dash 18 amendments create a Government Standards and Practices Commission Endowment Fund. The endowment would be sufficient to offer about $600,000 for the operation of government standards and practice. They would, in fact, live off the earnings. The endowment would reside in the office of the Secretary of, or excuse me, the office of the State Treasurer, and would be administered by them. The earnings would be transferred to the Oregon Government Standards and Practice Commission at the rate of 98.15%. And it would be a continuous appropriation to the Government Standards and Practices Commission. We'd make a one-time investment. We'd create the endowment fund. The earnings would support the Government Standards and Practices Commission, and that would be automatic from this point forward. And although it is not entirely beyond the reach of future legislatures, I think it would be very difficult for future legislatures to tamper with the endowment fund because the endowment fund would reside and exist outside of the general fund. And it would be dedicated wholly and specifically to GSPC. We worked with Legislative Council to create the vehicle. We had direct input from the State Treasurer's Office to make sure that the language actually achieves the objective. It eliminates a lot of accounting. It eliminates a lot of arguments, I believe, that would ensue from the assessment process. And because it uses general fund, you could say that all general fund sharing agencies are equally affected. And so there wouldn't be a necessity to do the mathematics required to figure out whether those assessments were fair and reasonable. You wouldn't have to make adjustments as people or agencies migrated up and down the fee schedule. It would be a one-time action by the legislature, and it seems to me to solve a lot of the issues about how far down the food chain you have to go to get the money to run GSPC. So, Madam Chair, I offer this amendment simply as an alternative that I think accomplishes two objectives, and that is to create a system, essentially, that is so much apart from the other processes of state government, that it has enough attention on it that people would see if somebody tried to tamper with it. It doesn't require the state legislature to do an appropriation and a limitation each year as we do with the other two dash amendments. And it does provide the resources necessary and apart to support GSPC.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. And I just comment, I actually think the purpose of the amendment is certainly very well intended, and I think it certainly achieves everything that we've tried to achieve. My concern is that I have just spent, since many of us, several sessions trying to create a rainy day fund. It took us a decade to do that. And right now, $14 million being locked up in an endowment fund seems quite difficult. But if the co-chairs can figure out a way to get us there, I'm totally supportive. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I'm moved by some of the ideas our good friend from John Day has put forward. One of the things that bothers me is your statement, how far down the food chain to get the money. And it seems to me from testimony that we have heard that much of the work of GSPC, in fact, the lion's share of the work comes from, as you put it, farther down the food chain. And I don't know why it is that the general fund should be the only entity with anything in the game, when the lion's share of the problems happen at the local government level. And immunizing them against participating in ethics oversight leaves me a little cool.
All right, Senator Farioli, and then we should probably move on.
You know, there's no disputation that by far the massive issues that are generated for GSPC come from the very entities that you described. My fear is that the local cemetery district and the smaller organizations that are primarily voluntary and only have an assessment to do the stuff they do, which is, you know, once a year they go out and reduce the fire hazard by cutting the lawns in the cemetery and pick up the brambles and so forth, will simply disincorporate rather than have the paperwork and the filing and the assessment and so forth. That may not be true, but I would suggest that the overriding public interest in GSPC attaches to every single citizen in Oregon. And virtually all the dollars that we get in tax money, are subject to the decisions of people who are in turn subject to GSPC. I would suggest that that the overriding public interest justifies a general fund investment, and avoiding the accounting issues that will generate costs for every one of these agencies and every one of these entities, whether they're voluntary or incorporated in some other mechanism, more than justifies the one-time investment.
Senator Johnson, and then I'm going to have you guys take your discussion out in the hallway so we can get through the rest of the amendments.
Madam Chair, while my good colleague has seen fit to see the glass as half empty by suggesting that smaller entities would disincorporate, I'm going to choose to see it as half full, that once a year as they filled out the paperwork, they would be reminded of their fiduciary and ethical responsibilities, and it would cause them, I think, to take the gravity of their appointment as a reminder of their ethical obligation to discharge their duties, whether it's mowing the grass or whether it's running a multi-million-dollar enterprise.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Rettlinger, will you continue walking us through the amendments, please?
I'm on the dash 15s on page 4 now.
Okay.
The next change that is made is to the lobbying reporting statute. Currently, the law is written to say that lobbyists on their lobbying reports must itemize expenditures in excess of $25, and then that's indexed to inflation beginning in 1979. All this amendment does is move the dollar figure up to $75, which is about where it is now under the indexing, I believe, and changes the index number from 1979 to beginning in 2009. So that happens both for lobbying reports and by reports required by lobbying entities. The next thing it does is electronic filing of statements, both by lobbyists and by people who are subject to filing under the ethics laws in Chapter 244. It would cover statements of economic interest and any additional statements that this bill requires. What the amendments do is allow the GSPC, require the GSPC to allow electronic filings of statements until 2010. And then in 2010, all statements must be filed electronically with the GSPC, both in the lobbying statutes and in the government standards and practices statutes.
Go ahead.
There's one issue that does need to be decided here. I'm not sure that I got it right. The way the bill is written now is that nothing kicks in until January 1st of 2009. In other words, the current system would apply till then. From 2009 to 2010, you could do paper or electronic. In 2010, it would be all electronic. You might want to change the date from January 1st, 2009 to January 1st, 2008 to require the GSPC to allow electronic or paper filings in both 2008 and 2009. That would assume, of course, that they would have time to get that system up and running. But just so you know, nothing happens until January 1st, 2009.
Okay. I look to my colleagues from rural Oregon, and that is the folks think that there will be, that Troy and some of the smaller communities will have, that's your district.
Yeah.
We'll have I know, but do we think, this is 2007, do we think in 3 years? We don't know.
They're still shooting folks off horses out there.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. That makes me feel good, really good. As long as they're not shooting the horses, I'm happy. So,
oh, we just lost two folks out there.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And over cattle.
Cattle fight, yeah.
Two people are dead. I mean...
Okay. So computers may be not quite accessible.
Maybe. We're still using lever action 3030s without telescopic sights.
Sarah Modest Anderson, did you have a comment?
I think that that is an issue, too, regarding someone. But if somehow that there could be a request or to get a waiver for doing that, and they had to have pretty good reasons for that, it'd be nice to set up by rule in a way for those people who truly don't have access or don't have the knowledge base.
Okay. Sarah Ferrielli?
Madam Chair, the question really, it was twofold. One was that there are some folks that simply don't have the capacity, and I'll add to the mythology from Eastern Oregon, airmail takes 2 days to get to John Day. We have to truck the airmail. The issue was that some folks might not be teched up, and the other issue was that running a new system and making it mandatory guarantees that there'll be some glitches and some failures. And so we'd like to have the agency have the time to run the system for a year parallel to a paper filing system before they mandate it.
Thank you. Okay. Move along.
Okay. Now I'm on page 7, moving to page 8. The amendment clarifies that if somebody has simply failed to file a required statement, whether it's a lobbying statement or a statement required under Chapter 244, that the GSPC may impose a civil penalty for failing to file the statement. They don't have to go through the long and involved investigatory phase and preliminary review phase and that statute that's about 6 pages long. They can just impose a penalty if somebody has simply failed to file the report. That's in current law. All this bill does is move it to a different section and reword it slightly. The next thing the amendments do is both for the lobbying laws and for Chapter 244 is it allows the GSPC to issue a written reprimand or explanation instead of imposing a civil penalty against a public official. The next big thing has to do with the use of campaign funds.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
My question about that is, I recall in an interim committee that I was on a lot of discussion about what a letter in lieu of a penalty would be called and whether or not there were gradations in the severity of a written reprimand or letter of correction or letter of education. And what I don't see from the language and from your explanation is that level of subtlety. Are we really trying to avoid a monetary penalty with a letter? Or do we want to have any kind of gradation in GSPC offering corrective advice that wouldn't go so far as to be a violation but would simply be corrective? Or are we seeing the world in such black and white that we figure every failure is somehow the kind of failure that would result in a penalty? Is all I'm looking for is, as this gets increasingly complex and some of us still have the benefit of relying on volunteers to do some of our stuff, I'm just trying to figure out, is there a gray area wherein you could have a letter of education?
Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, the bill now would require the GSPC to find that there was a violation of law, and then they could choose to not impose a penalty but issue a letter, a written something. What it says here is written reprimand or explanation. We could change those words to give them more flexibility, letter of explanation, letter of correction, whatever it is.
Some things probably, Madam Chair, deserve a reprimand. Some things may well simply be educational or letter of correction.
Jordan, do you want to come up and respond to that? I don't know. I think... I think you're raising two issues. One is whether this provides the GSPC with enough flexibility to have the discretion to issue
a letter in lieu of a fine.
Correct.
That's one of the questions.
But the other question is, can they also issue a letter of, you know, you need a little more education as opposed to a fine. So, Mr. Burson, I don't know if you want to respond to that, if you think this provides you with a higher level of flexibility.
For the record, my name is Ron Burson. Mm-hmm. I'm the executive director for the GSPC, and I apologize for my voice. I just came from the dentist, so I sound a little funny. So, the more flexibility that we have, probably the better off we'll be. And if we're interpreting this to say a written reprimand or explanation, if explanation allows me the opportunity to write a letter to somebody to explain the law and make an educational type of action, then I'm fine with this.
Senator Farrielli.
Madam Chair, I think beauty's in the eye of the beholder. And on line six, what I see is the in lieu of imposing a civil penalty language that allows the agency flexibility. There's clearly the authority to write a written reprimand, which I think talks about some level of culpability, perhaps short of the requirement of a civil penalty. And then I like the word explanation because I think that is a broad enough phrase that would say these, you know, we can see that you tried, you made the appropriate date, the content is a good attempt, but here's where your report fails by way of explanation. And I think that is less of a determination of breach or culpability or reprimand than it is an educational opportunity. So I would say that the points that my good colleague raises are actually addressed here. But if the word correction is a better word, I think that gets at the issue just as easily.
Okay.
So.
All right. I don't know. Yeah, we'll let you go back to your seat and suffer in the back row in silence.
Well, rows back, Madam Chair.
Yes. Well,
back.
Well, Mr. Rettlinger continues to
Thank
walk
you.
Through.
The next thing is use of campaign funds. What the bill says is that you cannot use principal campaign committee funds to pay criminal or civil penalties that may be imposed against you as a public official. However, there's an exception. You can use principal campaign committee funds to pay penalties that are election law penalties imposed under ORS Chapter 260. Mm-hmm. However, you cannot use civil penalties for violating the statute against the personal use of campaign funds or for violation of the statute that prohibits a candidate from paying the candidate for rendering professional services to the campaign. You couldn't pay out of principal campaign funds for those. The second piece.
I'm going to take questions on that before we get into any more, however. Any questions? Good. Keep going.
There's some double exceptions there.
Okay.
The second piece of that.
Okay. All right.
Exception to exception.
Yes.
Let's see. Legal expenses are added to this statute as well. You cannot use principal campaign committee funds to pay for legal expenses that are incurred by a candidate or by the public official where the legal proceeding relates to your scope of duties as a public official or as a candidate. And again, the same exceptions apply. You can use campaign funds to pay legal expenses for election law violations, except if you violate the statutes on personal use and paying yourself for professional services.
Yeah, it's just complicated.
It's complicated, no question about it.
I mean, we ought to be simplifying it rather than complicating it.
Okay, the next thing is the revolving door piece. What the bill says now is that a member of the legislature, a former member of the legislature, may not receive money or other consideration for lobbying during the period that starts when they leave the Legislative Assembly and that ends adjournment sine die of the next regular legislative session that starts after they leave the body. And there's an exception to that in the bill on page 9 that says for purposes of the special sessions which are planned for 2008 and 2010, those are considered to be regular legislative sessions for purposes of calculating the time limits. And then that section goes away on January 1st, 2011.
All right.
Questions? Yes, I have a question.
Senator Monica Anderson.
So that means the special legislative session in 2009 is not considered a regular session. Is that what this is saying?
No.
It's saying the reverse.
2008 is considered a regular session.
2008 is a regular session.
No, it's a special session. It's a special session, but for this, the revolving door purposes, it's
considered
being
as a regular session.
Yes.
Thank you.
Is that clear as mud? All right. Senator Farrielly, do you want to have a constitutional discussion?
Well, I do, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. And first of all, I compliment our counsel for trying to do the narrowest possible application of the law so that there is no constitutional question, but we're still in a gray area. The issue is the constitutional restraint of trade and what is perceived as protected speech and what is political speech. And I think you can make a really strong argument that lobbying is political speech and therefore protected under the First Amendment. You also can, I think, make a really strong argument that to say that people who have accumulated a great deal of knowledge about the system and how it works cannot be restrained from using that information in trade. So there's at least two issues that I think are litigable, and I am not an attorney. I have been talking to attorneys, and that's why I sound so confused. The bottom line here is that this bill, if it goes out with this ban, goes out with a kick me sign on it, and somebody will litigate this. And we may be developing a process that we feature severability in the bill because I think people are going to be knocking chunks off of this bill if and when it passes. The other issue I think was already touched upon. I think 08 is considered, even though it's a special session in the bill, it's treated as a regular session, and that means folks who choose to leave this building in the end of 2007 will be back in this building lobbying in 09, having set out for the 08 session. I'll also refer to an article in the Constitution. I think the framers were really clear at the beginning to the extent of their ability to foresee how complicated the web between legislators, lobbyists, administration members, and others that are connected to this process would get. Article 4, Section 30 says, members are not eligible to other offices. No senator or representative shall, during the time for which he may have been elected, be eligible to any office the election to which is vested in the Legislative Assembly, nor shall be appointed to any civil office of profit which shall have been created, or the emoluments of which shall be increased during such term. But this latter provision shall not be construed to apply to any officer elected by the people. We have, since 1998, seen six legislators appointed directly to administrative posts either during or shortly after their legislative service, all of whom voted on the increase of the emoluments to those agencies, and one of which was appointed to an agency which was created during their term of office with a piece of legislation they principally sponsored. The argument always is about the details, and right now the issue of the definition of office is what's at odds here. Office is held to be elective. So appointing these people to the administration doesn't violate the Constitution merely because the word office is in the Constitution, and office has been held to be elective. But I'll point the principle out. It was clearly intended that by the framers of our Constitution that there be a firewall between state legislators and appointments to public office for which they have voted an increase of the salary or helped create. That leads me to believe that we're somewhat deficient, in fact, in not preventing the revolving door definition to include not only legislators to lobbyists, but legislators to appointments within the administration. And there may be some others, and I pointed those out, lobbyists to administrators. It seems very odd to me that folks that may or may not have contributed or controlled contributions to major political offices would end up on the staff of those offices immediately after the election. And that leads us to the conversation that Senator Brown and I have been having about the possibility of a referral to a constitutional referral on the issue of the revolving door. So, you know, I'm not here to stand up and say, let's do the referral. I think that may be a conversation for another day. What I am here to say is that clearly the framers intended that there be a firewall between the state legislature and appointments to public office in the administration. And the language that we have in this draft amendment is a valiant attempt to try to make the revolving door issue to solve the problem between, you know, moving legislators into lobbyists. But I think those things are clearly at risk of legal challenge because of the restraint of trade issues, and also because the political speech, which is lobbying, among other things, is clearly protected by the First Amendment. So those are the issues that I'll put before the committee. I don't have a solution to offer. I'll just say that if the bill goes out like this, it goes out with a kick me sign on it.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you. If you did a referral for the Oregon Constitution and it passed, would the U.S. Constitution supersede the Oregon Constitution?
Chair Brown, Senator Nelson, yes, it would. But I believe that revolving door statutes have been upheld under the First Amendment. In fact, I believe it's
the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, the U.S. Constitution.
The U.S. Constitution. The real constitutional issue, I think, is with the Oregon Constitution,
mm-hmm.
with Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, because it has been interpreted to provide more protection for speech than the First Amendment does, which is why you can regulate other things in Washington and California that you can't regulate in Oregon, because our Constitution protects more speech.
Interesting, huh? I know, it's complicated.
How complicated. How are we going to make this simple? That's what I'm...
It's not easy. All right, let's move along.
Okay.
Page 9?
Yes, we're on page 9. We're into gifts now. And the definition of gifts... as you remember, Senate Bill 10 sets a $50 gift limit per calendar year from people who have a legislative or administrative interest. Current law sets that number at $100. What the amendments do is add some exemptions to the definition of gift. In other words, these are things that public officials could accept without violating the statutes. Right now, the bill exempts admission to and the cost of food and beverage consumed at an event where a public official is going to speak or appear to answer questions. The bill would add to that by also exempting the spouse of the public official and any staff who accompany the public official to the event. Those people could also receive the cost of admission and the food and beverage. The second thing it does in the bill now, the expenses related to attendance at conventions and things like that that are paid for by state governments, the federal government, nonprofits, those things would be exempt. This bill adds to that membership organizations to which a public body pays membership dues. It's designed to sweep in the National Conference of State Legislatures. Also... exempted.
So, question here.
There, Modest Anderson.
And I'll just throw this out. I'm not sure. OLCV has a huge dinner and wants to invite legislators, and most people have to pay $100 a plate. A legislator cannot accept that then.
Chair Brown, Senator Modest Anderson, under the bill, it would be subject to the $50 limit unless the legislator was appearing at the event to speak or to answer questions from people who were there.
Even though everybody was invited?
Yes, if everybody was invited, I'm assuming that everybody would have to pay the cost of admission and the cost of the food. And so the exemption would be there if you were attending in your official capacity to speak.
So, Senator Minus Anderson, just to, this is a little different than the House rules, and their rules are if everybody, I assume all members of the House are invited, then the limit doesn't apply. The problem with that in trying to put something like that into statute is that we're talking about 170 or 160 or 175,000 public officials, and the question would be whether, you know, would you invite the entire, would you have to invite the entire slate of public officials? Would you have to invite all of the elected officials? Would you invite the entire legislature in order to get that exemption? So we kind of wrestled with that approach, and I didn't have Mr. Ruttlinger draft it because I just thought it got a little complicated.
Well, just
go ahead.
And I can't remember which entity, maybe Oregon Business Alliance or Association.
I think it's OBA.
OBA. They had a real concern, and there's a number of people that go to that, but legislators do not have to pay, but they're all invited, and the way they attract a lot of people to that event is the fact that legislators are going to be there, so that, in a sense, a legislator could not attend unless they paid. Is that...
That's correct. There are two ways a legislator could pay under current law if this were to pass. One is through your own personal account. The other way would be the use of campaign dollars.
You could use campaign dollars for that.
Nothing in this bill prohibits that. As members are aware, there's other discussions happening about that particular issue. But... Senator Johnson?
Madam Chair, if we're teeing up a bill that will have 90 legislators at the podium, you can just sign me up as a no right now.
Okay.
about 170,000 public officials, Senator Nelson.
One of the issues I'm having with this is all the different figures. We've had $50, $75, and $100. And in the law commission thing, we had $15, $50, $75, $100, $250, $1,000, and $2,000. To me, you just have to pick a figure out here someplace. So everything is. And the question I have is, how does the standards of practice then audit this thing? And they've got all these different figures from different folks, and on one side you've got the ethics things, on the other side you've got the campaign finance reform. Seems to me, don't we have to put those things all together so that Mr. Mercy can check figures back and forth and say, okay, there's been a violation, there hasn't been a violation. I mean, how do we... I just think we're making this so complicated.
Mr. Burson, I don't know if you want to respond to that. No. Okay.
I assume non-response is assent, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, Mr. Burson. I actually would like him to respond. Simply because I think that Senator Nelson raises a very valid issue. We're building in a lot of layers here, and I want to know about enforcement, because if we end up passing a bill that sets in place a bunch of wink-wink, nudge-nudge kind of behavior, we will have set the cause back, not moved it forward. And so I'd like you to talk about enforcement and the degree of complication in all of these different numbers and how it is that people that want to follow the rules are going to know what the rules are.
Again, for the record, Ron Burson, Executive Director for GSPC. And it's going to be difficult. The agency has not done a great job of educating public officials on what they are, what is expected of them. In fact, your group is probably the most educated, and there's some difficulty there too. So I apologize for that. As the agency, I've always been in favor of making it as simple as possible, not only because I'm sure this group is going to want me to come back in the next session and describe how I am educating everyone out there. And, of course, the more different levels, as Senator Nelson pointed out, makes that more difficult to do. As far as on enforcement level, we can enforce that in that if there are different levels, we would be checking the individual public official's report versus the people that provided that meal or that gift to that person. So we could bring those two together, which doesn't happen at this time because current law, there is a difference between what a public official has to report and what an entity that's providing a gift or meals to a public official has to report. So they may not be report. They're not reporting the same thing. So all we've asked from the beginning of this is that to make sure whatever a public official has to report, whether it's $50 or $100 or whatever that level is, it's the same amount that the entity has to report. So we can come back and compare those two things. Now, can there be different levels for meals and gifts and things like this? Yes, we could still audit that just as long as, I say, both parties are reporting the same thing.
All right.
I hope that answers your question.
I think it does to some extent. I just want to make a couple of comments. I mean, Senator Nelson, I think in terms of the gift limit, the route this proposal has taken has gone to dollar amount with some exceptions. I mean, there's no question about that. The way to make it most simple, frankly, is to ban everything. And that would keep it very simple. But that means we would not be able to, and the firefighters would not be able to, and I know the Law Commission wrestled with this a whole lot, would not be able to take T-shirts and mugs and those kinds of things. Mayors would not be able to receive plaques. Folks would not, only those who have the personal resources or the campaign resources would be able to participate in conferences and trips. So if we really want to go simple, a total ban is probably the easiest, and it's frankly probably the easiest for Mr. Burson to go. Personally, I felt like that wasn't practical because of Oregon's expansive ethics laws reaching so many officials, 170,000. I know we're wrestling with them out, but 170,000. I also felt for the citizens who wanted to participate, like the homeschoolers bringing in apple pie or the community colleges giving mugs, and frankly a number of organizations awarding plaques, that is a way for them to congratulate and thank legislators or mayors or county commissioners. So, I mean, that would be one way to go. I do think you raise a good point in terms of consistency, and I want to go, and this is actually from Mr. Ruttlinger. On page 4, section 3A, we're talking about lobbying reporting. And as we move folks up to lobbying reporting, the total amount expended on on occasion, I'm on line 17 and 18, exceeds 75. In order to keep it consistent with the gift prohibition, shouldn't that remain 50 and only apply to exceptions? Or are we having lobby, for example, report everything, in which case it nullifies the comments Mr. Burson made about consistency in reporting?
Chair Brown, the number could certainly be moved to $50.
Okay.
Yes, I can't remember why it's at $75, okay, to tell you the truth.
Okay. And that, I think, would assist Mr. Burson's enforcement efforts. I don't know. Senator Nelson, did that help answer some of your questions?
A little bit. Just a response, if I could. I mean, another simple way to do it is to put a $100 or whatever figure it is, and have us report everything.
Right.
And then make everybody, then let the voter decide. I mean, what we're kind of doing here is saying, well, somebody else is going to decide whether you're ethical or not ethical. And in the final analysis, it's going to be the voter. And there, I think there's some argument for we ought to be encouraging that more money be spent in the political process.
And Senator Nelson, that's certainly an approach we could take. And I think, frankly, if you look at the cumulative approach under the House rules, and probably the chief clerk or Representative Gelser, who chairs the committee over there on this issue, could walk through better than I. But my understanding that their $10 limit is for each event. So essentially they could do 10 events with a lobbyist at $10. I think then you have the issue of, are folks willing to report everything? And this amendment took out the reporting requirements between $15 and $50 and prohibited events, with some exceptions, over $50. And I think having everything reported is certainly a legitimate option. I think we just chose, in terms of if we're worrying about a gotcha kind of situation, I was concerned, frankly, that the multiple reporting of multiple events got more complicated for folks. So,
yeah. Just another. So, I mean, I think we're not really operating under a set of principles. I know we're trying to keep the voter informed. We're trying to encourage people to be involved in the political process, whether as constituent or as elected official. We should try and make it easy to administer. We should try and foster some competitiveness, because are all these things we're doing going to benefit the incumbent over somebody who wants to challenge? I mean, I think I'm not so sure we're operating under a set of principles here when we're trying to accomplish something.
Senator,
other than show for the newspapers that we fixed the ethics law till the next time this stuff comes up.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
I would just respond respectfully. Had there not been some rules that were perceived as broken that triggered the press, trips would have gone unnoticed.
I think we ought to report those things. I mean, if that was the requirement that we report them, then I think all of us would have reported them. I mean, since I'm the fallen angel here, I mean, it was the reporting requirement saying, okay, anything over a certain amount. But if I was really the requirement, you report the trip, and then you let the voters make up your mind. If I'm going to Hawaii every 2 weeks, you're certainly going to have a different opinion whether I go once every 2 years or once every 4 years, something like that. So it goes back to the voters, what I'm trying to say.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Senator Nelson. I think we're almost done with the walkthrough, and we have a couple people signed up to testify. You're free again. can go back and suffer from your dental pain in the back seat there. And Mr. Ruttlinger, why don't you finish, take us home.
Okay. Also exempt from the gift definition and the gift limits would be food, lodging, and travel expenses provided to a public official, a spouse, and staff that accompany the public official when the public official is representing state government or local government on an official trade promotion or fact-finding mission outside the United States. Also exempted would be food.
Question. Those of us who don't have a spouse but like to take a daughter or a son.
Madam Chair, Senator Montes,
or a guest.
That would not be allowed under this language. If you wanted a relative, then we should put relative in there instead of spouse.
Well, and Senator Montes Anderson, not necessarily the legislation we passed today, but legislation we anticipate will pass in the House will certainly may impact the word spouse. So I think that's certainly a legitimate question. If folks can come up with a narrow exemption, I think I would be certainly willing to go there. So.
Okay. Also exempted would be...
I want to say specifically the issue of... I'm just going to use an example. The governor attends a number of events, and the governor would like to have his spouse come with him at some events. I suspect she doesn't really want to go to a number of events, but, you know, certainly folks want that option. You raise a totally legitimate point, and if we can figure out a way to keep that narrow, we may be willing to go there. Senator Farrelly.
As long as he only takes her bowling and it's less than $50. They can go anywhere in the state.
Okay. Additional exemptions would be food and beverage that a public official consumes when the public official is acting in the official capacity regarding borrowing, investment, or financial transactions while engaged in due diligence research for presentations by the Office of the State Treasurer. Related to investment or borrowing, or while meeting with the governing body of a corporation or some other entity in which the Office of the State Treasurer has invested monies. Then, further on the gift limits, what this bill does is exempt judges and people in the judicial department from the gift limit piece. In other words, the gift limits would not apply to them. The judicial codes of conduct and other things would continue to apply to the judges. Then on gift reporting, the amendments delete the requirement that public officials and candidates report gifts that they receive that have a value of between $15 and $50. It also deletes the requirement that people who give gifts between $15 and $50 report those gifts. And then finally, on the legal expenses trust fund, the amendments change the bill. The bill originally says that you could establish a legal expenses trust fund for defensive purposes if you, a public official, had a public body bring some sort of legal proceeding against you. You could set up a legal expense trust fund, raise money, and use that to pay your legal fees. And this bill would allow it to go either way. If you had any sort of legal expenses that were incurred in a legal proceeding that arose just because you were a public official, in other words, because you took legal action, you could also set up a legal expenses trust fund and raise money and use that to pay your lawyers. That's all.
Madam Chair. Sarah Johnson.
What's the terminus of the trust fund if you don't use all the money that's in it?
The bill, okay. Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, in the end of the bill, sections 36 and 37 talk about how the fund is terminated. If you have money left when you're terminated, you can distribute it back to contributors, to a nonprofit, et cetera.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrelly.
So, Mr. Ruttlinger, I think I just heard you say that I can start a legal defense trust fund for offensive purposes as well as defensive purposes?
Chair Brown, Senator Farrelly, I may have said that, yes. What the bill says is that you may use funds from a legal expenses trust fund to defray legal expenses that you incur in any legal proceeding or investigation that relates to or arises from the scope and duties, the course and scope of duties that you have as a public official. So if you...
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Senator Farrelly.
So if I decide that there's enough of a constitutional gray area in this bill, I can raise a defense fund and litigate it?
Well...
That was a good question.
Chair Brown, Senator Farrelly, that is a good question. I don't think that that's entirely what's contemplated by this bill, because, I mean, in that case, you could argue that you are using your position to raise money that you should be paying for yourself to do this case.
Madam Chairman, I bitterly regret having asked that question before this bill passes. I bet he can fix this.
Senator Farrelly, if you're looking for a sort of a concrete example of this, I know that a handful of elected officials, legislators, have been,
named in legal proceedings, Madam Chair.
Correct. Named in legal proceedings have been stopped, and this would give those legislators or public officials an opportunity to raise resources for their legal defense.
Madam Chair, I think the whole of the legislative leadership of this building was named in legal proceedings for failing to fully fund the quality education model a year and a half ago. And
correct.
My co-defendant here on the dais and I went to our legal counsel for defense. But would this have given us a mechanism to raise funds for our defense if we'd have needed to, Madam Chair?
Senator Farrelly, I believe that it would have. Luckily, the court in his wisdom saw to get rid of individual legislators, and the matter was taken care of pretty quickly.
But. Madam Chairman, that was a decision cheered by many people until they realized that the getting rid of only meant the lawsuit.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Ruttlinger? Senator Minas Anderson.
Yes. If you have a spouse and you go somewhere, the combination couldn't be more than $50. I'm going back to, I'm still, now I'm onto this spouse
this
bit.
This is on the trade mission.
This is, that is well, only for the trade mission.
Or if you're
mission.
Speaking at an event.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And I think there are a couple of options as I'm sort of, my brain is thinking through. We could delete spouse altogether. That would be one option. We could say guest, so that the single folks in the world can take a friend. You could include relative, and then you're going to get in, probably Mr. Burson is going to get into the issue of whether, you know, who is a relative,
mm-hmm.
or we just delete it altogether. So I think there are a number of options there, and let's think about it over the next day or so.
Thank you.
But I want to be, I think the word is ecumenical about this, fair to all. All right, Mr. Ruttlinger, thank you very much. I think you're off the hook for this evening. If we could, Mr. Burson, do you want to come up and testify on any specific thing? You're signed up to testify, so. You don't have to.
Yeah, he's taking a pass, Madam Chair.
Okay. I've got Ms. Ingram. Would you like to come up? Ms. Thompson? Ms. Eaton? We know you've been here since 7:15. Do you want to come on up? Or?
Thank you.
Okay. Treasurer's office.
Send it back.
Oh, come on up.
It's Andy.
What's Andy's
last name? Madam Chair, members of the committee, Janua Ingram represents Special Districts Association, Oregon Five District Directors Association, and others. We had just a couple of hours to review the amendments, and Special Districts Association and the other entities I represent did ask me to express a preference for the Dash 15 amendments and the way they felt it was a cleaner way of assessing the funds. However, I was sitting in the back of the room and just kind of going over them one more time, and I just, one little thing caught my eye, and maybe it isn't an issue at all, but I'm looking at the amendment, and I believe it's in the Dash 15s, that talks about amending page 13 of the bill, where it talks about the gift exemption, and one of the exemptions is listed in lines 23 through 25, admission to and the cost of food or beverage consumed at a reception, meal, or meeting held by an organization, and then there's the amendment wants to insert to which a public body pays dues. At least one of the organizations I represent is trying to phase out their dues process.
Okay.
So I don't know if that would mean that in order for them to invite a legislator
mm-hmm.
to come and speak at their luncheon, they would want to charge at least $1, and that seemed a little disingenuous, but I wanted to flag it.
Okay.
But otherwise, we like the Dash 15. And thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Thompson.
Janice Thompson, Money and Politics Research Action Project. A handful of comments, and again, thank you all for hanging in there, because I think the final result of this will be a very commendable project to send on. The first item relating to the Dash 18 amendments is that regarding the trust fund approach is that, the endowment fund, rather, excuse me. I was involved in conversations with Senator Brown dating back to 2003 trying to figure out some way to kind of meet this independent goal. And actually, this idea did occur to me, and I did not bring it to her attention because of the, you know, large fiscal impact. And so I just have to say, better you than me for bringing it up.
Senator Ferrielli?
Madam Chair, I'd like to just point out that it's a 0.0001% of the general fund. It's
right.
Relative to the $14 billion that we're playing with, this is not a lot of money. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Ferrielli.
Chair, Senator Ferrielli, I actually realize that. But I think Senator Brown's comments about, you know, even this amount is difficult, makes it an appealing idea that I'm troubled would get bogged down for other reasons. And I think we're just so close. I'm very, very concerned about that. The other issue I would raise with this approach is, what do you do if at some point in the future, because of some adjustments in the GSP's scope of their activity, that no longer enough funds are being generated? In terms of the use of campaign funds issue that's reflected in here, I think actually this should be characterized as simplifying things. It's like, if you have elections fines, you can use these funds. If you have other kinds of fines, you use the legal expense fund. I think it simplifies things, makes a lot of sense. In terms of the revolving door and this constitutional issue, this has been, you know, was definitely discussed by the ethics work group. I would just point out that revolving door restrictions are in place already for many other public officials in the state. And so that kick me sign, if you will, has been out there for quite some time. And nobody's kicked yet. Now, one way to look at that is, if you do this, it's going to, like, you know, the tide's going to turn and somebody is finally going to kick. I guess I would say, let them kick. Because I think if at this point you shift to the constitutional referral on this point, you just have opened up a whole can of worms about those other items that, again, are, you know, are you know, that whole, like I say, that basically that kick me sign has been out there for a while. In terms of the
Senator Johnson,
Janice, could you give some examples?
Oh, geez. I think many number, there are several agency heads. I think PUC.
Thank you.
Right.
Yeah, PUC. Thank you.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at.
Thank you.
In other words, I mean, that kind of gets back to, we're asking all these other folks to abide by these rules. I think this is just asking legislators to abide by the same rules. In terms of the, you know, some of the discussions about the House rules and adopting some of the ideas from the House rules are internal rules. I think were really designed for the legislative session, and the job in Senate Bill 10 is to really design things that will work for all public officials. And so I think this whole notion that somehow if you invited everybody, that should be okay, just does not work in this setting. And quite frankly, even in the House rules as it is right now, I actually would characterize as a loophole. And it's a particularly troubling loophole because the only people who can use it are people with deep pockets. I mean, you know, to use the loophole, you have to be able to, you know, comp an event for 60 people. I mean, it's not even like, anyway, so I think that's just really not a direction to go. And I think what's really commendable about Senate Bill 10's approach with regards to the gift limit is it really is designed to be applicable to the wide range of public officials. There's been, you know, input by the governor's office and the treasurer's office, and I think it's really reflects a level of discussion about how things need to work outside of just the legislative session.
Madam Chair. Senator Johnson.
I want to come back and visit what you just said about the deep pockets and comp an event for 60 people. That frequently happens. I can think of all sorts of dinners invitations that come complimentary to the legislature. And they cut across a vast spectrum. I mean, they're not all from the oil companies.
Right. I think, Sarah Johnson, she's referring to the House rules
right.
that allow members to not comply with the $10 limit if every member of the House is invited to an event. And I agree with you. That happens a lot.
I just want to be clear on the record that I think the assertion that it is just the somehow suggesting these nefarious wealthy guys, the deep pockets, we get those invitations from a vast cross-section of folks that you wouldn't ordinarily think of as the deep pockets.
Anything else, Ms. Thompson?
One clarifying question, which about this whole 75 versus 50, if Ted's not here, maybe I'll just hold it.
And I couldn't tell without comparing it to the text of the bill itself.
I guess in general, on the enforcement question this whole notion of an audit and things like that, I'm also starting conversations with folks on the House Rules Committee because, as you know, the Law Commission sent a lot of bills, and one in particular I think is going to be a House bill, and folks are already taking, doing quite a bit of due diligence about, dovetailing this together. So I think a lot of these internal consistencies are going to be dealt with in that kind of discussion.
Okay. Thank you.
So that's it.
Ms. Miller, and I'm sorry I couldn't remember your last name.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Andy Miller, Senior Policy Analyst at the Oregon Business Association. I had not planned to testify or become in any way publicly involved with this topic, lest it be perceived as the OBA amendment. And I sat back there and I listened to y'all talk and scared myself because I actually agreed with Senator Farioli on something on the funding mechanism. I thought that was a simple, clean idea. And Senator Nelson really made me think. What is the benefit to the constituent and the public of having the interaction with their legislators in a public environment? To me, that exceeds the benefit to the elected official. We are much happier to see you than you are to see us. You're there because we honor you. We honor Margaret Carter and Dave Frommeyer at our last event. We honor you. That's why you're there. We can do it with $50. You will be eating hot dogs and cheese whiz, and we will have soap and turf. But we will still honor you. No, I know that we can work something out. It does change our paradigm, the whole thing, and it's huge to us, but it shouldn't be the ethical discussion we're having. But I want to put it more on an ethical plane. The opportunity to interact with large groups of constituents in a bipartisan manner, in a spirit of honoring state leaders, to me seems like a good thing. So why are we making this a punitive thing, a difficult thing? Somehow it's bad that you're all getting this because the value exceeds an arbitrary. And I say $50 is ridiculously low, but it's an arbitrary limit. More importantly, very problematic that you so severely limit the gifts and then you say, oh, by the way, just use your campaign funds. What is that about? That is the opposite of good government. That is the opposite of ethics. So you push it in here and it pops out there. And I hate it when my boss is right. But Lynn said to me, you're never gonna do this unless you stop both places. Because I was advising him on crafting our legislative agenda. And darn if he wasn't right. And it's popping out right there. And I went to the hearing when we discussed personal use of campaign funds and people went ballistic. And really took offense at being treated like criminals, and this was a bipartisan situation. It was in your rules, in your committee on the Senate Bill 700.
Legislative operations.
So what I want to say is, what is corruption or the appearance of corruption? What are you actually fixing here? If you're real clear that you're actually fixing something, then we won't oppose this bill under any circumstance, but I thought you ought to know that there's been a lot of thinking here. What we do want is stable, adequate, and independent funding. I think Senator Farioli's idea has merit. Getting it out of the co-chairs may require some prioritizing that many people aren't prepared to do, but it's a very good idea, and it's a good fix, and we do have the money now. And the more timely and frequent reporting is huge. That is what will give you the transparency. And I'm sorry, you know, the pencil thing is not good for your folks in wherever it is in the wheat country, but the online version is lovely. It will work better. You will get used to it. We all will. Lynn has, believe it or not, a BlackBerry. That is really funny. But that's where we're going to get at the problems. The funding. Give the people the money to do their job, money to get an investigator, make the system work better. The reporting forms are so hard, I don't know how to fill them out. And I've been filling them out a long time. And that's kind of my speech. I have spoken, as Mammy Yocum said. Yeah.
Thank you. Sarah Johnson.
Is there a mechanism, and I haven't done the math, and there's a really good reason for that. I'm a liberal arts kind of guy, so I can't do the math. Could we fill a fund incrementally? Maybe the question is best posed to Senator Farioli. I know the idea is to get enough of a corpus that it is throwing off adequate interest to drive the expenses, but would there be an incremental possibility of filling it? I am loath to let cities and counties and all these special districts off the hook.
Before we go further down this path, I would like if the OBA is really saying, you know, we support the endowment fund, I know that the former speaker, Lynn Lundquist, has worked for 10 years to get the rainy day fund. I want to see from people specifically where they would either get the starting dollars or the entire amount, because otherwise this is just a very nice theoretical discussion.
Dear Brown, I must say that comment was in the theoretical realm. I'm not authorized to make that statement for OBA. I'm just saying the simplicity of the idea
was
attractive.
It totally is beautiful. I totally agree with that. I just, you know, we were beating our heads against a wall for a decade, and I know other people for two decades, to even put any general fund money aside for a savings account, knowing that Oregon is, you know, dependent on the income tax, we've got, you know, recessions on a decade regular basis. If folks come forward and there's, you know, 31 and 16 votes saying, okay, they're willing to reduce K through 12 or community corrections or the Department of Human Services budget by either $2 million for the next couple of bienniums or $14 million, I'm happy to go there because I do. The principle is great. It totally is. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chairman, if you appropriate the dollars and then assess them back, you're doing it anyway. So, you know, I'd be very interested in incrementally building the fund, but that there's a teachable moment once in a while, and there's a mood to reform once in a while. And if the whole concept behind the endowment fund, in fact, that grew out of a discussion in this room that we had about the value of symbolism and the value of commitment and the value of prioritization. This is a time when people expect us to move forward boldly to do something about GSPC funding, which has been a political football and caused the agency to have essentially starvation diet for years. The endowment fund sends a very powerful message about our willingness to prioritize this issue. It is not a great deal of money. It is not spending the money, $14 million. It's putting that money aside and dedicating it so that it will grow as a corpus and throw off the dollars. And if we schedule the earnings to keep pace with inflation, which we in fact are doing, then I think we solve the problem of grounding out down the road as the need grows. I would like to simply ask that we keep an open mind about the possibility. I'll do some diligence. What it comes down to, Madam Chair, is that we could send this amendment in the bill to Ways and Means and have a further argument there. If there is no mechanism for convincing our colleagues in the subcommittee and then the full Ways and Means Committee, they would simply have the option of removing that and adding the painfully Byzantine schedule for assessment and appropriation that we see in the original two amendments.
And Senator Farrelly, again, I appreciate the concept. I think it's a brilliant idea. I think that the problem is, as you so frequently say, the devil's in the details. And just one thing, the amount, if you're looking at $600,000 in biannual interest, that only gives us about three-quarters of the way there. So the fund you're probably looking at, if your calculations were accurate, is more than $14 million. And I'm sure that I believe this is going to Representative Jensen's committee. And I'm sure that if you guys can work together and find the $15 to $20 million that this needs for base funding and then a way to increase resources over time for the agency, I'm happy to go there. So, Senator Nelson, and then we need to bring up Mr. Winkles. And go ahead.
Just a quick question to Andy is, were you saying that the direction that Senate Bill 10 is going to limit the interaction between elected political officials and their constituencies?
Chair Brown, Senator Nelson, in the case of OBA, yes, it most definitely will. I certainly would not hold up the bill on that reasoning, but I think you need to consider that. And no one sort of, in our zeal, and I have been previously identified as a zealot, to close the loopholes, we may have overlooked a larger public good. And that's just something that came to me in the back room, again, listening to the conversation.
Thank you. Ms. Thompson.
Chair Brown, Senator Nelson, if I may chime in. I don't think it will. I think it'll just look different. Mm-hmm. And it'll happen on a more level playing field, based on folks' ability to convince people to attend events on the basis of the ideas and the discussion, rather than the ability of somebody to foot a bill. I think it'll just look different.
Just all one right. Little comment.
Sure. The chair's going to have to leave here pretty soon. So.
I know. You know how many events.
I'll take the gavel.
Yeah, great.
I probably, and during session, it's more frequent, but even in the interim, it's not uncommon to go to an event, a big event, with a $100 fundraiser once a week.
More.
Yes.
More for some people. And so it's very difficult for those of us, even if we had a decent campaign, we wouldn't go. We would stop going because we are invited to so many during the week. And I enjoy going to them, but if I have to foot the bill, I'm sorry. I'm not going.
Sure.
Chair Brown, just one final comment. I do appreciate Senator Mona Sanderson's comment about the availability of the Internet. Believe it or not, I have two board members who I cannot send email to. I have to send it either to a next-door neighbor or to the fire chief because they just do not have email. And so I am sensitive to that. And I wanted to let Senator Farrelly know that our lack of endorsement of his amendments was not a judgment on them. We just had not seen them until we walked in the door. So we will be circulating those to our members as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. The three of you. Mr. Winkles, why don't you come on up? And Senator Farrelly.
Madam Chair, thank you. Since we're not contemplating a work session today, there's ample opportunity for endorsement. Madam Chair, in point of fact, the governor's budget has a $1 million budget item for GSPC for the biennium. The endowment fund will throw off $600,000 per year, $1.2 million, at the current level.
Okay, great.
So,
all
there
right,
you
thank
go.
You. I stand corrected. My understanding was a biannual fee, so that's great. Mr. Winkles.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. Given the hour, I will be as brief as humanly possible. I would like to speak in favor of the Dash 16 amendments, particularly the funding mechanism. As you might imagine, my members are not wildly enthusiastic in regards to the idea of paying for the GSPC, but we feel that the mechanism contained in the Dash 16 amendment is the cleanest, most fair method of doing so.
Thank you. And since I think it was the League's suggestion, I really appreciate your comments. Senator Farrelly, I'm sure they would support your endowment fund concept.
Well, I was just pointing out that, Madam Chair, that was not the substance of my remarks, but now that you bring it up, it's a great idea. I think there was a telepathic communication between me and one of the members of the audience that caused me to check my numbers, and the governor's budget has somewhat less than $1 million in for GSPC in this round.
I think it's about 900,000.
Right. So the point is it's not quite $1 million. The endowment fund would create 1.2 million per biennium. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Winkles. All right. Any further questions? Appreciate your comments, your concerns, your frustrations. I think our goal is to, and Senator Mona Sanders, I totally hear what you're saying about dinners and stuff. I think the issue is for whether or not, as elected officials, we attend events that the average John Q. Public or the Jane Q. Public isn't able to afford to attend. And I think the question is, you know, do we hold ourselves to a higher standard, a different standard, or a lower standard than we have right now? And I think our goal here is to strengthen the ethics laws in the state. So I certainly hear your concerns. Senator Nelson.
Just to follow up on that, I think our goal here should be is how do you promote the interaction between constituents and elected people, their elected officials, so that we understand where they're coming from and they understand where we're coming from. That's the danger I see in this bill, is that we are limiting that interaction and that we're not doing what we should be accomplishing.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Anybody else? All right. With that, we'll be back. You want to come up quickly?
Senator Brown, members of the committee, for the record, Wendy Johnson, Oregon Law Commission. I didn't plan to testify. I was kind of seeing how those amendments would work out. But I do want to make three points because I know you're really working on trying to finish this bill up to move it out. But I want to just make three points. On the revolving door issue, as Senator Farrelly pointed out, there are constitutional issues. The Law Commission struggled with that and worked with Ted Bertlinger to make it as narrow as possible. But there's one thing that hasn't been talked about, and that's the timing of when that revolving door would kick in. As was mentioned, there are revolving door prohibitions on PUC members, other administrative agency heads and such, but they take those positions knowing what job restrictions they have on them later. And when you signed up to be a legislator, you didn't know that you could be restricted on what you can be for lobbying. And
there
so you will see in the Law Commission's recommendations that we don't restrict legislators who are presently serving. Now, if you re-up and you've now got the restriction, it would apply to you. So I think you should keep that restraint on trade issue in mind, is that we thought through that issue of is it right? I mean, we think it's a good policy to put in a revolving door, but the question is, when do you put it in? Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that the House wanted to make it apply to people right now, and that's a policy choice, but it's a restriction that it's like a waiver for those people who are appointed to those positions. So I wanted to just put that on the record.
Excellent. Good point.
Second, regarding food and beverage, I know the Law Commission may be criticized for not putting more restrictions on food and beverage. We struggled with that a great deal, but we really heard from the public, as Senator Nelson pointed out, that wants people to come to events. We heard from small pocket organizations who say, you know, the only way I'm going to get time is a lunch. And we rely on those small, you know, not a lot of money, but In the United States, we do have coffee breaks, we do have cookies, we have lunch, we have dinner. It's an amount of time. So we did not restrict food and beverage. We do require reporting if it's more than $75. And I think that's important to keep in mind that the public cares about lavish meals. And so if you're spending more than $75, we kept that rule that you have to itemize.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I just want to make sure, Wendy, refresh my recollection, that we said you had to, the Law Commission's work, that we said you had to report if it was more than 75, but there was the reciprocal reporting. As I recall, the lobbyist had to give notice that it was more than 75.
Chair Brown, Senator Johnson. I looked at that again, and it's not in the present Law Commission recommendations, and I don't know if that's an oversight or if that was intentional. For everything else, there is reciprocal, but for food and beverage, there's not a reciprocal requirement. Only the lobbyist and the entity has to report. I believe that was because folks don't often know what the bill is going to be until the end of the meal, and it's just it's a it's a difficult thing to deal with, but obviously you could require that. That would be a way to increase reporting and take care of the perceived perception. I think it's important to keep in mind of what was the whole goal here. As Senator Nelson pointed out, it was to deal with public perception a large part and make things easier. Food and beverage has never been restricted in Oregon. It's always been unlimited, except for the itemization of $75, more than $75 by a lobbyist or entity. We kept that. But it was not an easy decision. But I also let you know that you can do as the House did, which is restrict it on your own. It's always a floor for every governmental body to decide. But do we really want the GSPC to have to count every cup of coffee and every lunch? Because I'm not sure. I think it's been sort of talked about tonight. I just want to make it clear on the record that the way Senate Bill 10 reads is that all food counts as a gift. And so all food counts towards your $50 limit. So a bunch of flowers and a lunch might be it for you for the year from a given organization. So a banquet at the OSB or whatever it is, that's your $50 for the year. So there will be nothing else. Now, I don't want to criticize the work of Senate Bill 10, but I just want to point out why the Law Commission left food and beverage the way it is. And unfortunately, you haven't had a chance to hear that bill yet. So I'm in an awkward spot of trying to talk about what we did when you've got a different bill before you. But I think that's an important point to make, that will all have to now be reported at every $15 increment. But what's tricky about it is if the lunch was $16, I have to report it. But if the lunch was $14, I don't have to report it, but I got to keep track of it because it goes towards the $50.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's going to have to be an honor system. And I don't know how it's going to work for poor GSPC. My third point is regarding trips. The Law Commission left that totally the way it is in terms of unlimited, but we required a lot more reporting and a lot more frequent reporting, and we required more participation. Senate Bill 10 goes a different way and allows trips by three groups: nonprofits, government, and tribes. This came from Colorado, where Indian tribes have a lot of power. So you can get unlimited.
No, actually, we added the tribes. The tribes was not in the Colorado provision.
Okay.
So.
Well, that shows that tribes have a lot of power here.
So those three, you can get unlimited trips, but the way I read the bill is that you cannot get trips from other interests. And as we
That's
know,
correct.
That government has
unless
a
sliver of Unless
interest.
It's a dues-paying entity. Unless there were a dues-paying entity, or it's the under the treasurer's exemption and you've got your trade mission scope. So
most trips are not going to be permitted.
Correct.
I hadn't heard any discussion about the difference between a for-profit and a non-profit, because many times they're doing the same type of education, but one is going to be permitted and one would not be permitted. I also see the word reasonable in some of the provisions that isn't there now, and that's just going to create more work for the GSPC to determine what's a reasonable cost for an event in terms of travel. So those are just my three big picture points that I wanted to make.
Thank you. Appreciate your comments. Any other questions? Thank you all very much.
Comment?
Senator Farrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we need to work on the all food counts thing as a gift. That isn't going to work. I don't know how we're going to aggregate that stuff and record it. It's on the honor system, so and it's $9.99 for the House. It isn't $10. They can't go to $10. It's $9.99. Madam Chair, one of the things that we talked about earlier and seems to have dropped out of the process is there needs to be some protection for people who seek and receive an opinion from GSPC, follow that opinion, and then later are found to have broken a rule. So it's got to be somewhere stated that if you seek an opinion from GSPC and get an opinion and follow it, that you can't later be held liable or culpable for having done the thing that you got the advice on. So that's an important thing. Finally, I think that this last witness talks about the thing that I think that Senator Nelson and others have alluded to. Reporting is the issue. Clarity, transparency, frequency of reporting is what we're really aiming at here. I think the issue of the race to the bottom is one that we've watched with a bit of amusement, only because it's happening in the House and not the Senate. What amused me this week was the Secretary of State gave each and every legislator a copy of the Blue Book, a hardbound copy of the Blue Book, which is valued at about $15. They had to revise the rules of the House to allow the gift. We cannot chase the numbers or the issues like that and retain any sense of credibility with the public. So I think what we need to do is set the limit, eliminate food and beverage or go back to something that's sensible, make the limit reasonable, and then make reporting the focus of this whole issue so that disclosure, transparency, and frequency are the principles that we hold up. Thank you. Oh, and by the way, Madam Chair, I'd like to thank again the State Treasurer for being available to answer questions on the best solution that's so far been put forward to fund GSPC. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Any further comments? Thank you all very much. We'll see you on Friday afternoon. We're adjourned.